Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Here's what we're squawking about today. The market's highs, WeWork's lows, and what investors are watching from China's big party.
Send home the message from Beijing that China is great again.
Plus, tech entrepreneur Alexis Ohanian on building up new companies.
Every business needs to be a software business now.
And better ingredients, new leadership, better pizza, Papa John's new CEO.
I don't believe, and our company doesn't believe, that all pizza is created equal.
We've got those stories and more. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Wilfred Frost and Mike Santoli. Joe and Andrew are off today. Let's check out the market, though. Stocks are having their best start to the year since 1997. Let's check out the returns for the year so far. The Dow up by 15%, the S&P up by 19%, and then the NASDAQ up by 22%. Mike, you love this when we emphasize year to date, don't you?
Look, it's real. The numbers are, they're factual. I just think it's a unique year in the sense that we had such a dramatic low point in the markets right before the calendar year clicked over. So if you look at 1 year ago today, the S&P 500, October 1st, 2018, closed at 2924. And this morning we're in the 2980-ish. So I think that you could spin that both ways, right? You could say, the market really isn't looking very stretched to the upside because we've kind of been going sideways for most of the year.
Right.
In 1997, for example, the year started at an all-time high, and then you went up 20% in three quarters.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's true. You forget about where we were on Christmas Eve. We had just taken that huge plunge.
Exactly. 20% down in less than 3 months.
Okay. Well, we got it back.
Exactly. And that's the good part.
The other snapshot, though, which is interesting on Q3's performance, kind of similar Europe to the U.S., but China lagged significantly.
Yes. Yeah.
And just again, where we are in the trade war, who's hurting more, who's hurting less. Down about 4.7% for the quarter, which is, you know, much more significant than a slight gain that you've got over the 3 months for the U.S. markets.
Two dramatic scenes in Asia kicked things off on Squawk Box today. Pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong clashed with police on what is a symbolically important day. October 1st is the National Day of the People's Republic of China, marking the anniversary of the 1949 founding of the Communist Party, and the party was partying. As we went to air this morning, China's President Xi Jinping was speaking in Beijing. The first sounds are from reporter Eunice Yoon, who was standing in front of a theatrical and patriotic backdrop of a massive event in Tiananmen Square.
Good morning, Eunice.
Good morning, Wilfred. While preparations are underway, 60,000 people are expected to come here on Tiananmen Square, including China's top leaders, to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic. There's an evening gala, and then a little bit later on tonight, a fireworks display. And all of this, of course, is to send home the message from Beijing that China is great again. President Xi Jinping earlier this morning had kicked off the military parade by saying that no force can stop the Chinese people and the Chinese nation from forging ahead. At the same time, President Xi had reiterated that China is committed to peace. Now, that message was in stark contrast to the military hardware display that we saw today, including an intercontinental ballistic missile that Beijing unveiled for the first time, called the DF-41, which is said to be capable to hit any target in the United States. President Xi had also made a veiled warning to Hong Kong, reiterating that China is very committed to the One China principle. Also, another reminder to Taiwan. Now, for investors, in his speech, there was very little when it comes to reforms or China's international role in the world. And that was suggesting to many here that the message at the end of the day for investors is that China is going to continue with its hardline nationalistic stance. And that could have an impact on the trade talks, because this, what we're seeing here, is the political backdrop of the Vice Premier Liu He, who is heading to Washington next week. And with this type of event as the backdrop for him going in to those discussions, it seems very difficult for him to have a whole lot of flexibility that in a way that to show make any concessions that could potentially show China as a weaker party than the United States. Guys?
Eunice, I don't know if you can hear us because I realize it's really loud behind you, but I did hear some reports this morning suggesting that anytime there's been weakness in the economy, the manufacturing numbers that have been showing some contraction there, that anytime that weakness has come, it's been pretty easy to blame President Trump. What do you hear on the streets there?
Well, people do worry about the trade war, but there are also a lot of other economists who say that we are seeing a weakness in the economy, not only because of the trade war, which is seen here as an initiative that was launched by President Trump, but also because of other economic reasons such as that have nothing to do with the U.S., such as the debt levels, the fact that China, even before the trade war, was actually trying to slow things down. So the weakness that we're seeing in the economy isn't entirely being blamed on President Trump, though, of course, there are a lot of people who say that the trade war has been exacerbating the situation, especially people who I speak to in the manufacturing sector.
Eunice, thank you very much. Eunice Yoon. Meantime, in Hong Kong, protesters are clashing with police. That's where we find CNBC's Sherry Kang. Sherry, what can you tell us?
Well, it's a certainly urban battlegrounds here in Hong Kong, marking that 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China here in Hong Kong. Some hardcore anti-government, pro-democracy protesters are marking that day, setting many different parts of the city on fire, and police actually responding with the tear gas, and certainly at a level that we haven't really seen this past summer. Yes, there has been an escalation gradually in the level of aggression coming from both sides. But today, marking that special occasion of the National Day, we've got high alerts for many key areas of protest. And it's very difficult, by the way, anecdotally, to find a live position for our team and myself, because these protesters are moving in a very fast manner to beat the police arrests. And there have been at least a dozen arrests have been made as well. There is a report in a local media that one protester has been shot by a live round shot fired by a police officer. Now, CNBC has not been able to verify independently. This comes against the backdrop of the Hong Kong government scaling things down in terms of National Day celebration. For example, fireworks that's in schedule normally have been canceled. Flag raising ceremony this morning has been moved indoors as well. Certainly, tiptoeing around just so that they avoid the worst case scenario. And we are hearing and seeing a number of fire trucks and ambulances being deployed as we speak. Guys, back to you.
Sherry, you mentioned that the protesters are moving quickly, trying to stay ahead of the police. But even the pictures that we saw, the video that was running through, didn't seem like the protests were anywhere near the size that we've seen in the past. What can you tell us just about the scale and the scope of them right now?
Well, it's just practically all over the Hong Kong Island. It's many different parts of Hong Kong, and it's many different factions or groups of protesters trying to dodge the arrests and clashes with the Hong Kong police. But also, one important point that I need to make here is that the main march that was happening across Hong Kong Island that involved thousands of pro-democracy protesters did manage to march in a peaceful manner. But really, towards the nightfall, things do get aggressive as some of the hardcore protesters refuse to go home after marching. Guys?
Sherry, thank you very much. Sherry Kang.
In global news, the Brexit deadline now just 30 days away. Yesterday, I sat down with former UK Prime Minister, who of course delivered and lost the EU referendum back in 2016, David Cameron, and asked him which way he thought things were likely to head over the final month.
I hope we get a deal, but if we don't, I think we're going to have to find another way of unblocking the situation, possibly through a general election. But I also wouldn't rule out a second referendum. It wouldn't be my first choice. But we are stuck. We can't go on being stuck. And in the end, there are only three ways to unstick it. That's to have a deal that Parliament will approve, to have a general election and a new Parliament, or to have a second referendum.
I also asked him whether he thought there could be another Eurozone crisis in the years ahead.
I worry about the stability of the euro. I mean, one of the reasons I launched, in fact, the main reason, the biggest reason for trying to have a renegotiation and referendum was to recognize that the eurozone was driving change in Europe. Those eurozone countries are inevitably going to have a deeper union amongst themselves. They're going to have more coordinated fiscal policy, more coordinated banking action. That has consequences for Britain. And I worry, in a way, if they do those things, I was worried about how Britain would relate to that, but I also worry if they don't do those things, will the eurozone be able to cope with the next financial crisis that comes along? And I think that is a real worry.
Cameron recently has expressed some remorse and regret mm-hmm. about actually calling for this the first time around.
Well, his book is pretty open in terms of him saying, I failed, called a referendum and lost that result. The one big criticism that people still have with all the media interviews he's done and as far as he went in the book, you've got to applaud that part of the admission, but he still says that the holding the referendum at all was inevitable. Most people disagree with that and also go further to say he called it in order to help his own domestic political chances, which helped him get a victory in 2015 in the general election. So that would be where most people criticize that he hasn't gone far enough in his admission of guilt. But you also juxtapose it to a lot of today's politicians, and just an admission of guilt at all, to some level, is perhaps commendable. The other slight criticism as well that we did talk about, and I would say is worth watching back because I thought it was really interesting, is there's been so much criticism of the lies or exaggerations of the Leave campaign. And I did also ask him whether his Remain campaign was perfectly truthful, and he admitted that it wasn't. I mean, yes, he's gone further than some politicians, but still seen ultimately as calling a referendum that people say wasn't totally necessary and losing it. And that is ultimately, for all he can write about, his biggest legacy.
WeWork has scrapped plans for an IPO for now, but will the company's troubles put the commercial real estate market at risk? Robert Frank joins us now with more on that. Hey, Robert.
Good morning, Mike. Well, WeWork is the largest commercial tenant in Manhattan with over 7 million square feet of space. So the collateral damage from WeWork's troubles could spread to landlords, to lenters, and the broader commercial market. Now, the building behind me is a WeWork building called 88 University Place. It is in downtown Manhattan. Now, it is partly owned by Adam Neumann, of course, the former CEO of WeWork. WeWork leases the building from Neumann and his partners. IBM subleases from WeWork. Now, the building is now for sale. And this sale is being widely watched as the new bellwether for WeWork's possible impact on the market. Now, the asking price for this building right now is $110 million, but brokers say it's going to be tough to get that price. And that is because Neumann and his partners bought this building in 2015 through an LLC with his partner, the fashion designer Eli Tahari. They paid $70 million. Now, there is debt on top of debt in this building. So, of course, Neumann borrowed from J.P. Morgan and others to buy this building and others. And there is a $78 million loan in addition to that on the building. So the debt on this building is now larger than the purchase price. Now, the problem here is that Manhattan right now has a huge oversupply of commercial space. You have projects like Hudson Yards and World Trade Center. And WeWork has absorbed much of that growth so far.
Hey, Robert, how unusual is it to ask for a price that others think is going to be crazy and you're never going to get anywhere near that?
Well, we see it all the time in residential real estate in Manhattan.
Right.
But commercial real estate is typically a smarter market. Now, when you look at comps, 110 is high, but WeWork would argue they have improved not just the building, and they put millions of dollars, or Adam Neumann and his partners did, into new elevators, new heating and air conditioning systems. And this is a great neighborhood. WeWork argues they make neighborhoods and building values go up when they come in. But that, of course, is the big question for this will be the test for what is the WeWork either premium or discount to a building. We've seen a couple of WeWork buildings pulled from the market recently because the landlords were nervous about selling. This could be the first test.
So, in other words, it's a tech commercial real estate building, not just a real estate building.
Exactly.
Robert, thank you.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, Alexis Ohanian, the co-founder of Reddit, turned venture capitalist on the wild, uneven market for hot companies going public.
What is clear is this IPO roadshow trend is falling out of style.
You're listening to Squawk Pod, taking you behind the sounds of Squawk Box on CNBC. Today, Alexis Ohanian, who joined the show from Florida this morning. He co-founded news and discussion site Reddit, and even though he left the company in 2018, he's still close to the culture there. Nowadays, he's managing his own venture capital firm, Initialized Capital. They're early stage investors, so Alexis is watching the market for startup companies wanting to go public and big tech regulation very closely. I caught up with Becky Quick at the NASDAQ after the show.
So Alexis Ohanian is an old friend of Squawk Box, and he joined us remote this morning on the show.
He did, and I love Alexis. Every time he comes on, he tells me something that opens my eyes a little bit. And I think he always speaks incredibly honestly. He's not telling you what he thinks will help his side of things. He tells you what he actually sees, which I always appreciate in a guest. This morning we talked with Alexis about a couple of issues. One is, how is Silicon Valley and how are venture capitalists kind of looking at the deals they do now in light of the IPOs that we've seen this year? A lot of numbers that have gotten taken down, and then there's the Wii IPO that is not going to happen, but you know, going from $47 billion to $10 or $15 billion. How does that change the way they think? And he had an interesting answer. He said part of this is a revaluing of what's happening, but he also said he thinks it has something to do with the street and a lot of problems that Silicon Valley see with Wall Street set up for how they do business. I think the most interesting thing with Alexis is just this idea that Silicon Valley thinks that Wall Street is fleecing them. He didn't even mince words or deny it when I asked him that directly. Alexis, thanks for being here. It's great to see you.
Very good to be here.
Alexis, let's just talk about what you've seen so far with the IPO market. How has that trickled down into the Valley? And is that changing the way venture capital firms start looking at new funding that they're putting to work today?
You know, what is clear is this IPO roadshow trend is falling out of style. I think one of the things that has been most apparent to most CEOs of late in tech is that for all of the virtues and the excitement of becoming a publicly traded company, the way that the public markets work in terms of incentivizing CEOs to focus on short-term as opposed to long-term has been a challenge. And I think we're seeing more and more alternatives be devised and crafted. We were early investors in Long-Term Stock Exchange, which wants to be a way for CEOs to get their companies some liquidity, but to do so in a way that's responsible for long-term investment.
Alexis, it's so interesting to hear you say that, because I was talking to a guest last week who said the mood in Silicon Valley right now is to try and stick it to the bankers, that they're sick of kind of getting held up by what's happening with the IPO. And if they can, hose the bankers for another 5 cents, they're going to do it. But then if you look at something like the direct listing that Slack just listed, that didn't perform so well either. So what's the answer?
I think a different model for even how these exchanges can work is really in order. One that incentivizes people who have had positions of the companies for longer terms to have a bigger vote, but also one that really takes into consideration the fact that, you know, stock prices change every second, and yet the actual value of companies don't change nearly that often. So how do we really think about even the fundamentals of how these marketplaces work that allow for liquidity to happen, but at the same time take into account the fact that we want companies to be focused on long-term growth as opposed to quick sort of impulse decisions?
I think that's part of the problem, but let's also just confront what the private market valuations have gotten kind of out of control. When you start looking at a lot of them involved with SoftBank, where they were looking for the long haul, we're building growth at any cost. Okay, try selling that to the public that you're now going to continue to lose money for an indefinite amount of time and expect that you're going to get nosebleed valuations. Is that just over?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, later stage private investors have been valuing companies a lot differently than the public markets, which are much more ruthless. And I think it's going to sound very obvious, but gross margins really do matter here. And there is truth to the fact that every business needs to be a software business now. I really do believe that. The difference, however, though, is the private markets have been valuing a lot of companies that are a lot less software than they are other things, and the margins reflect that. They don't have traditional software-type margins, whereas the companies that have IPO'd this year that do, Zoom being probably one of the most prominent ones, have actually performed well. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that they are much more true to those sort of gross margin ideals of software. And it's those later stage private markups that have gotten hit as they've met with the reality of the public markets.
That's actually a great point. Just building on that, how would you value a company? And I'm just using these as examples because they're out there right now. WeWork being a commercial real estate company versus being a tech company. And so many of the other ones that are out there, how do you find a fair valuation for these companies that are saying they're technology companies when in reality they're using technology just like every other company is right now?
Yeah, and look, there is a difference between companies that are sort of not traditionally software companies, but that have the product teams and the software teams internally that are able to build it. But at the end of the day, I think commercial real estate is a great example of a space where companies should be judged on their ability to generate cash flow. It is a really straightforward metric. It's one that's been used for a very long time for these types of companies, and it's a great way to show that they're onto something, they are building something that's sustainable, and that just doesn't look like 10x on revenue, which is how software companies tend to be valued.
Alexis, whatever the precise numbers are on WeWork's most recent private round and its value today, have you, as an investor, ever gone into something and seen within a year, 18 months, its value be some 25% of what you had invested in? And if so, would you expect to get a pass and still have your credibility going forward? Or how many passes do you think investors in early stage companies should get for those types of errors?
Yeah, well, so we're fortunate at Initialize, we do such early stage investing. We're often the first check that we do see these down rounds from time to time, but they're not that significant because the amount of money that's been invested, the size of the business is still very, very small relative to what we're talking about here. I think there is a real question now. It has been something we've talked about on air before that these private investors have been able to enjoy up rounds as companies have held off going public that normally retail investors would be able to get. We're seeing that now really get dialed back, and I think there's going to have to be a lot more sobriety when these later stage firms are doing these valuations. Because you know the markets in many ways have spoken on how these companies should be valued. I do at the end of the day think there is a truth here, which is every business doesn't need to be a software business, but every business should not necessarily be valued at software type levels.
Is the takeaway though from that, Alexis, that ultimately with the volume of money still in venture capital hands looking for these big opportunities, and if you don't have that ultimate exit from the public market that's willing to kind of bless those aggressive valuations, is there just not too much money chasing a more finite group of great opportunities than we thought before?
I still believe in the value of the entrepreneur. I still believe in innovation. I still think a few of these companies that have had disappointing IPOs are going to actually in the long term be very, very viable businesses. And so I still really believe that there is a lot more innovation to come. And while, yes, the later stage is awash in capital right now, there are many more great companies being founded and being invested in and that are going to make good use of that money.
One more quick question, Alexis. When you look at all of the noise in Washington and in other places where regulators are kind of checking out what's happening with big tech, is that something that's flowing down to the VC level? Is it changing the way people invest right now in Silicon Valley?
We love investing in David against Goliath. And if these wins are any indication, those Goliaths are going to have a lot more scrutiny and actually probably see some form of regulation or another. And so that just means more opportunity for the Davids, more opportunities for the upstarts to start to challenge them. And so, if anything, I suppose it gets us a little bit more excited on the early side of things because we see more opportunities for companies to come in and drink their milkshake. But at the end of the day, you know, we don't do our jobs because we want help from Washington to regulate or enforce. We do our jobs because we believe in these entrepreneurs providing, you know, real challenges and real improvement.
Alexis, thank you. I always love having you on. Next time, make sure you come here. We'll get you pizza, and we'll catch up on all the gossip that we missed here, too. Great to see
Deal.
You.
Deal.
Okay. Alexis,
thank
O'Hanlon.
Next on Squawk Pod, the new CEO of Papa John's. 1 month on the job. He's got an activist investor. He's got tough competition. He's got Shaquille O'Neal. Papa John's trying to serve up a new business strategy.
We believe that there are customers who want a better pizza.
The smell in here right now is incredible.
That's next. This is Squawk Pod. Here's Wilford Frost sitting behind a fresh pizza pie.
The smell in here right now is incredible. Joining us to talk about the pizza business is Rob Lynch, CEO of Papa John's Pizza. Rob, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for bringing our very healthy breakfast here.
Yeah, we love to show our products out here.
Let's take a quick look back on Papa John's last rough couple of years, starting with this guy.
I'm John Schnatter, Papa John.
Schnatter founded Papa John's when he was in his 20s with the proceeds from selling a Chevy Camaro. In 2017, Schnatter publicly criticized NFL leadership over the league's national anthem protests. Sales plummeted, and Papa John's lost its status as the official pizza of pro football. Schnatter stepped down as CEO but stayed on as chairman. The controversy continued. In 2018, Schnatter used the N-word on a business conference call. Papa John's ousted its eponymous leader from the board, and a bitter breakup followed. Schnatter sued the company he created and ultimately settled last spring. He was the company's largest individual shareholder, and he's since begun selling off his stake. Meanwhile, Papa John's has worked to turn around its reputation, removing Schnatter's image from its pizza boxes and naming former NBA star Shaquille O'Neal the new public face of the brand.
Pizza's fun. Everyone knows Shaquille O'Neal. They know that I'm in the fun business, and we want to get this thing back on track.
Papa John's new CEO, Rob Lynch, joined us this morning to discuss the company's efforts to recoup its slice of the pizza market.
First question in your place as a new CEO, what's the biggest threat to your business? Is it the traditional rival pizza companies, or is it now all types of food given the growth of delivery apps?
Well, I mean, the threat is not necessarily how we look at it. We look at it as an opportunity. Technology is disrupting our industry as it's disrupted the restaurant industry. And disruption obviously creates opportunity for those that are willing to dive in. So we feel like the apps, the third-party aggregators, can be partners. We can work with them to reach more customers and do it more efficiently. For us, we're strategically working with them. I was actually out in California last week meeting with all the major aggregators to build long-range plans on how we can help each other be successful.
And is your biggest incentive to invest in making your own apps really easy to use so you don't have to necessarily give margin away to them? Or is it, in fact, offering new types of food on your own app so that you're not just offering pizza as the other apps are?
You know, our mobile applications are a big part of our business, actually the fastest growing piece of our business. It grew over 60% over the last year. So we're making big investments in our IT infrastructure to support that, both the consumer facing side as well as the back end. You know, one-to-one marketing and all the information that we get from our loyalty program allows us to more effectively target our customers. So technology is a big platform for us.
And in terms of the dialogue that you've had an activist investor in Starboard, you've come on relatively recently. How's that dialogue? Is it going well?
It's been great. You know, Jeff Smith is an amazing partner. Jeff was actually the person that reached out to me about this opportunity. And, you know, a lot of folks would be a little bit scared, you know, coming into an activist situation, but Jeff's not like that. Jeff is actually working with us. He's very consumer-centric. He's very, focused on the business. Actually is a big idea guy, has more ideas in the R&D kitchen than we can bring to life. So working with Starboard and Jeff has been fantastic.
How often do you talk to him? Because I just want to know, is this a situation where you really like hearing from him or not? There aren't too many CEOs who say that. Greg Brown said that about Carl Icahn. But really, how much do you interact with him? What's it like?
You know, when I first joined the company about a month ago, he was in our office and he was working with me on a daily basis, and we were talking about all the things that he had been working on over the last 7 months since he had become a big investor in the company. Over the last 3 weeks, he's stepped back. He's allowed me to spend time with our franchisees and with our employees to better understand what I need to do. And so on an ongoing basis right now, we have a phone call once a week. But he is very available. He tells me, Rob, you can call me any time of the day. So I try not to bother him. But he's been really great about allowing me to get up to speed on the business.
The industry, if you look at just the advertising and the competition, it's very value oriented. I mean, it seems like that's the brand presentation all the time, is you get a lot more for your dollar. Is that okay for indefinitely, or do you have to try to get away from those constant kind of discounting moves?
That's what I'm working on. I don't believe, and our company doesn't believe, that all pizza is created equal. You know, we believe that there is a customer out there who values higher quality ingredients. I mean, we invest a lot into the ingredients that go into our pizza. I mean, our dough is fresh, never frozen. We have no artificial colors or flavors, you know, no fillers in our meats. We do a lot. That costs us a lot of money. That's investment, right? And so if we can't make that a return on that investment, then we shouldn't be doing that. We believe that there are customers who want a better pizza.
Do you have the same level of investment and quality in terms of the things people can order on the side, which you're perhaps not as well known for? Is that an area that you can potentially improve?
Yeah, one thing that a lot of our customers aren't aware of is just how good our wings are. We have chicken wings. I mean, pizza and wings go together great, right? So when people are sitting around watching football or any other activity, you know, we want them to order our wings. And our wings are, you know, come through the oven. They're not straight out of a fryer, so they have a little bit of a different roasted texture, which I love. And so I think our sides, we focus on making sure that they're the highest quality as well.
Back to the food apps, how much kind of percentage do they take from you guys? And do you think, with the broad number of competition and apps that there are in the food delivery space, that they're all going to survive? Or do you think that there's going to be a bit of consolidation there?
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity for consolidation. But, you know, the way I think about it is, what does the customer want, right? I mean, business models are driven by customer demand. And the customers have spoken. These apps are growing really rapidly because the customers want these services. And so, yes, they have had an impact on our industry, an impact on our business, but we believe that's because we haven't worked strategically with them. It's been kind of a zero-sum game. We don't think it needs to be that way. And so that's why I'm partnering with the CEOs of all of the aggregators to figure out how we can work together over the long term to both benefit.
Rob, thanks for joining us. Great to see you.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. On our rundown tomorrow, the CEO of Adidas, or Adidas, depending on where in the world you're listening to us, the German athletic company is trying to make the world's first recyclable shoe. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin, weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.